This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Tune into hip-hop today, and you're likely to hear rappers sampling old jazz and soul songs. Questions of who owns the music, who has the rights to perform it, sell it, appropriate its style, all of that certainly plays an important part in the music industry today. But borrowing music from other artists is nothing new. For centuries, musicians have sampled from one another, and along the way, there have been attempts to police these collaborations. A couple of Duke professors took the long view in a new book that tells the story of musical borrowing through the ages. In fact, it is a 300-page comic book called Theft, A History of Music. The release party for the book is tomorrow at Oval Park Grill in Durham. James Boyle is one of the co-authors of the book, and he's with me now. He's also a professor of law at Duke University. Jamie, welcome back. Good to have you here.
It's always good to be back in the WUNC Batcave.
It's good. Yeah, Batcave. This is it. This is a comic book that you've done, as I say, 300 pages that details the history of musical borrowing. What's behind this? What was the idea behind this book?
Well, we are primarily intellectual property scholars, and as we looked at changes partly in law, but mainly in culture, what people think they have to ask permission for, we started asking ourselves, would jazz be legal today? Would the blues be legal today? Would rock and roll be legal today? Would all of the borrowing and influence that made those great art forms what they are, would a license have to be obtained each time, a royalty paid every time you soloed? It seemed absurd. And the more we looked at it, the more we thought, we're not sure those art forms would be created today. We worried about that. Started to write a book about it, then decided, we need to go further back in history. And 2,000 years later, there was the comic book.
So take us back to the beginning. And how does the ancient Greece and the music that was produced there figure into any of this question?
Well, one of the things that we're talking about is the relationship between music and its technologies. And those obviously interact. You get one kind of music if you have no recorded music. You have musicians working on patronage. You get another kind of music if you have 45s being sold in a record store. The first real great music technology is notation. It literally is the invention of writing, musically speaking. Tunes can be passed down, carried through the centuries, improved upon, built upon. And so one of the things that we do is in looking at the origins of notation, and actually is even before ancient Greece, but looking at the origins of music in ancient Greece. And one of the things we found is that actually the Greeks, too, were worried about musical borrowing. Plato wanted to ban it, wanted the state to ban it, because he thought music went through our mental firewall and it could influence the mind on a deep level. So he didn't want mixing of the musical modes. So Plato was your first anti-rapper, as it were.
Okay. And he was worried about mixing modes. It's fascinating. Of course, their notation wasn't as precise as nor was the copying technology, so there was a fair amount of improvisation.
Absolutely. And initially, notation is just relational. It's like you go up from here or down from here, but you don't know where you're starting. Gradually, notation becomes more sophisticated, falls out of use in the Dark Ages, is reinvented. And then when it's reinvented, it's actually as part, there are many reasons for it, but one of them was an attempt by the Holy Roman Empire to introduce a standard mass, a standard liturgy, and a standard set of songs that you would hear in every cathedral in the empire. So this is the first sort of attempt to use a technology to help control music.
It moved to a fine art, as it were, with the technology of the printing press, and sort of print capitalism has a profound effect on music at this point. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. For the first time, you can have people not only making complicated polyphonic music, because if you think about it, how do I explain to five other musicians that you play this while I play that, while somebody else plays that? You also have music becoming truly continental in scope. People now can draw on different kinds of music, and it allows different relationships for composers. For the first time, there's the possibility, and this takes hundreds of years, for composers actually to make a living other than through patronage, because I can actually sell my sheet music to the public because people are sitting in their living rooms and want to be able to perform those great songs.
And who did own it? Because we know in publishing with map publishers and others, it was the publisher who owned it. So what was the tug of war between the composer and the publisher, and how did those relationships work?
Well, it's a fascinating one. There are lots of different stories. The first time we find someone actually getting control over musical printing in Venice, it's actually someone who's invents a new technology for it and gets basically a monopoly of printing in Venice as a result. Other composers got very limited monopolies because they said their work was pleasing to the church and so should be protected. But we don't see real copyright over music until 1707, Statute of Anne in Britain, And the application of copyright to music takes really well into the 19th century before we see any major effect.
But as you say, this also changes the relationship of the composer and musician to their audience. It's no longer finding a rich duke who's going to support you in the court. You can now appeal to the masses.
You can appeal to the masses, and that changes the nature of the music in the process. Some people would say for the better, some people would say for the worse. But it also means that because musicians and composers are freed of the influence of patronage, they're also freed of the need to curry favor with the powerful if they can reach a mass market. And I think that is, on balance, something that we should reward and encourage, because it means we get a decentralized system of music production.
But it also means that you have to be kind of savvy about what it is the public want. I mean, the fact is that those courts, you know, educated and inculcated their children to understand and appreciate this music. Perhaps the masses weren't as finely tuned. And so how do you know what those folk are going to want?
Well, largely through feedback, trial and error, lots of error. But also I think there's a conscious attempt to shape popular choice. And so you see musicians who span this divide really becoming kind of thought leaders on what musical styles are. And for the first time, think of people building a brand, not in the contemporary social media sense, but actually trying to have a sound which people are trained to like.
This is the subtext of your book, and I want to take this moment now to sort of highlight that, and then we'll get back to some of the details, which is that it is technology and ownership, the ideas around ownership and changing technology that really shape the music and culture that we create. It's not just, these things just don't happen. There are important influences like ownership and technology that change the way we understand music.
We try to lay out those dimensions to say the aesthetics are vital, but the aesthetics don't exist in a vacuum. They're in a technological medium. They're in a medium of how musicians get paid, get influence, get heard. And all of those things come together to tell the story of music. And one of the things in the book is we're passionate about music. And we think most people are, certainly when they're teenagers. Music is the thing that is probably the second most important thing to you other than the person that you have an unrequited crush on. And so what we wanted to do is say, you know, the music you love, the music that is you to some extent, it comes from this history. And so we wrote this book, and we also decided, well, we want everybody to have this. So we, you know, you can download it for free. If you Google Theft a History of Music, you can get that story for yourself.
It is free. True to the idea and your study of the public domain and the commons. It is a comic book. Why did you choose this particular format?
Well, as you know, many years ago, we had done a comic book on explaining fair use to the new creators of the digital world, copyright laws, fair use. And we thought, okay, well, a few filmmakers will download this, maybe a few musicians. So it's been downloaded more than a million times. And we realized that there was a market out there. People wanted to learn about things, but they wanted to learn about subtle things, but they wanted it in an accessible form. And so our book has literally 10 years of academic research behind it, but we try and present it in an accessible form, and we try and tell the story that music people love, rock and roll, soul, the blues, rap. It's all in there. It's not just the ancient Greeks.
And you've got characters from Tales from the Crypt, Rocky and Bullwinkle. We've got the Professor Peabody, of course, if you're traveling in time, and the DeLorean. Did you have to get the rights for that?
No, this is an exercise of fair use, as a matter of fact. We're talking about culture jamming, and what better way to talk about culture jamming than by culture jamming ourselves? So we have the TARDIS. We have pretty much a small but significant prize to any WUNC listener who can identify all of the time machines that we use in the book.
Well, all of these questions of appropriation and ownership really come to a head in the 20th century with the birth of rock and roll. Nothing more controversial or more interesting in the history of music. And you would say that maybe Chuck Berry in some ways brought together many of the elements that would become rock and roll.
Absolutely. And rest in peace, Mr. Berry just passed away at the age of 90. A wonderful inventive musician. But as we note, it's not a musician who, because he was African-American and playing in a segregated era, didn't have the audience initially that he should have. But this is a person who brings in country music and actually incorporates it with rhythm and blues. Our story is that rock and roll is remixed, that America is a remix nation, and Chuck Berry exemplifies that.
Let's listen to Chuck Berry's Maybelline.
Be true, oh Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started doing the things you used to do.
All right, really well-known song. Chuck Berry, in many ways, one of the co-creators of rock and roll. But as you say, he has to pay homage to bands and country and western music, including Bob Willis and the Texas Playboys in the 1930s. Here's a clip from their song, Ida Red.
Light and fall of farm, the great clock on the mantel, it's getting late. Curtains on the windows, snowy white. The parlor's flooding on Sunday night. I'd
read, I'm plumb fool about I'd read.
Here we go. A clip from Ida Red, Bob Willis and the Texas Playboys, and we're talking about Jamie Boyle's book, a book that he co-wrote with Jennifer Jenkins, law professors at Duke University. The book is called Theft, A History of Music. And so he jams those things together and comes up. Talk about your concern that perhaps this music would have been illegal today, given today's rules about it.
Well, if you look at all of these traditions, jazz, rhythm and blues, soul, which is one of the main examples we talk about, rock and roll itself, they're all taking from other music, not just simply copying. I mean, listeners could probably hear the similarities in those two songs, but being influenced by them. And one of the other things that's going on is they're copying across the color line, which at the time creates enormous anxiety and, frankly, racist responses in many of the listeners. People rightly see rock and roll as something that can actually bridge a racial divide, and it does. And Chuck Berry exemplifies the way in which that happened.
Terrified him down here in the South. You've got quotes from all kinds of people, George Wallace's speechwriter and George Wallace himself and others, terrified at how this race mixing would be facilitated through rock and roll. And, of course, one of the exemplars of this, and transgression, of course, is central to rock and roll. The idea of breaking all these barriers. Little Richard, perhaps the most transgressive of them all. Let's listen to his version of Tutti Frutti, well-known version. Little Richard's version of Tutti Frutti. So I was shocked to read in your book, because we know there's been a lot of course, Hound Dog, obviously, that, you know, Elvis Presley's version of Hound Dog, which he took from other sources. But that Pat Boone did a version of Tutti Frutti shocked me. Bomb bomb, Pat Boone. Who knew? I guess somebody knew. He sold that record, I guess.
That was one of the more disturbing things we discovered in research of the comic. And frankly, Mr. Boone made a complete hash of the song. But that was one of the things that happened. Some of this was just simple unfairness to African-American performers. White performers would produce often uncredited versions of their songs, cleaning them up and removing those African vibes that were thought to be so dangerous. But in some cases, what happened was a much more dynamic process. The Elvis and Big Mama Thornton, Hound Dog, written by two white songwriters, Lieber and Stoller, initially recorded by Big Mama Thornton, black artist, then re-recorded by Elvis with a different version, adding in rockabilly. That was something which was just jumping back. This is America, the Remix Nation, and in our sense, a much more joyful creation. And frankly, Elvis is a lot better than Pat Boone.
Right. This idea, also, what I discovered in your book, so there's the around Tutti Frutti, some of the greatest discoveries in the book, Little Richard, and we know part of that transgression was his gender bending performance, which you learned was not so much just to shock people, but in fact to get himself into the clubs.
Yeah, the people were extremely worried that we wouldn't just have musical miscegenation, we'd have actual miscegenation. The races would mingle and find each other attractive, and it might lead to dancing. So Little Richard said overtly that he deliberately put on eyelashes and lipstick, makeup, and as he said, because it would make him seem unthreatening, and so he could play white clubs. And this was one of the ways in which the color line was slowly and insidiously breached to all of our benefit. And what's interesting is the NAACP was cheering this on, was saying this is part of racial progress in America.
We have about a minute and a half left, which is sad because I wanted to talk about the spiritual, the way the spiritual and secular music blended as well. And we've got examples of this that you can tell us about in the 20th century, but they actually go back much further. But let's talk about the 20th century examples of this.
Well, certainly. We found, particularly with Ray Charles, who we just use as an exemplar, he took, on the one hand, gospel music, ecstatic gospel music, and on the other hand, rhythm and blues, and literally mashed them together to make a new genre, soul, in a way that might well be illegal today if he didn't ask permission. And permission might not be granted because these are religious songs he's taking.
Now, let's take an example of that. This is Ray Charles' Girl of Mine.
Do you know that this little girl of mine, I want you people to know, this little girl of mine, I take her everywhere we go. One day I looked at my suit was new. I looked at my shoes and they were too, and that's why I...
Now, there we go. Little Ray Charles, Girl of Mine. You might recognize the tune as This Little Light of Mine, a famous spiritual song.
Yes, he took it pretty much directly from Clara Ward's This Little Light of Mine. And Clara Ward and other gospel singers objected. They thought this was transgressive, and you can see their point. But on the other hand, if every time this happens, someone's asking for permission and paying a fee, you wonder, would we ever have got soul? Yeah. Charles says he loves musical mixed marriages, and I have to agree.
We've got about now 20 seconds left, but this also goes back to the Middle Ages when troubadours were having to clean up their work by singing love songs to the Virgin Mary.
They did indeed. Their remarkably bawdy songs were then turned into the Mass, which is a little-known fact that we discovered researching the book.
It's great stuff. Jamie Boyle, co-creator of a new comic book called Theft, A History of Music, a release party of the book tomorrow at 5 at Oval Park Grill in Durham. Jamie, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You can find out more about our show and the book at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director, North Carolina Public Radio's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.